Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for the dawn of America
of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. Welcome to the Banal of America coronavirus. Coronavirus special report number 9 with Dr. Tyler Kochjohn. Welcome back, my friend, Dr. Tyler.
Hey, thank you. Good to be here.
As I teased at the end of the show last week and in the little write-up here for tonight's show, I think this is probably, barring some crazy development in like the next week or so, I think this is probably our last or penultimate weekly installment of the coronavirus special report. As I was saying to Tyler before we came on the air, it's like I just, you know, it's weird because when we started all this, everything had this real like breaking news vibe to it, and we started our first episode of this little mini series was back on March 13th, and things were happening fast and furious because I remember I was going to just do a one-off show with Tyler, and I was like, we need to stay on this story. Because this story is just going to keep, this story is just going to keep getting crazier and crazier. And it did for a long time. And it's still crazy. It's still really, really crazy. But now it feels like we've settled into this the novelty, no pun intended, with the novel coronavirus. The novelty of all this has really kind of worn off, in a sense. People have adjusted to the fact that we now live in this world where we're just dealing with this fucking coronavirus all the time. And so, to me, I feel like maybe it's time to sort of, we talked a lot on the show about sort of, you know, the valve, loosening the valve and going back to work and reopening America and all that stuff. I feel like maybe it's time for us here at Banal of America to sort of, I don't know, loosen or tighten the valve or just sort of adjust what we're doing here a little bit. And so this will be the penultimate weekly installment of the coronavirus crisis special report. And next week we'll go out with a bang, and then Tyler will be back sometime in the future for sporadic updates on the situation. So even though next week is the coronavirus special report number 10, I like to end things on a 10. So we finished Banal Americas on season 10. We're going to wrap up the coronavirus crisis special report at episode 10, and then we'll reconvene. We'll get back together again, me and Tyler, in about 6 weeks or something like that to assess the situation and get a feel for where we're at. Because now it seems like everything was just, like I said before, everything was happening at this breakneck pace, and now things have kind of really slowed down to a remarkable degree, and people have adjusted to this life that we're living in, where we just have this fucking shitty-ass plague looming over us. And it's really remarkable. I mean, I don't know if you've taken the time to sort of think about it, Tyler. I have, where just sort of that this is like, as I said to you, I saw somebody say this on TV, it's not the new normal, it's the now normal. This is what's normal now, that we live in this world where there's this plague, essentially. There's this terrible virus, and it's tearing people apart. It's causing all. It's just torn society asunder. I mean, have you ever kind of stopped in the last few weeks just to like look at what the fuck is happening and be like, dear God, what? Wow.
Yes, it is amazing that you would think that at a time when we would be united against the common enemy, we found ways to fight each other politically. And that's fascinating and disheartening at the same time. It's unfortunate. I mean, you know, we're not always going to agree on everything, but it was to me very amazing at how quick the lines became drawn politically. And it's just a fascinating sort of thing to watch. I wish it wasn't that way, but that's how it's drawn. So here we are.
Yeah, it's really that is. It's really disappointing. And you know, we've certainly delved into the political end of things on here, but begrudgingly. I think I can get away with saying that. I've tried to keep this as relatively apolitical as possible, despite my own political leanings and everything. But it, that's another aspect of sort of taking a step back and saying, okay, maybe it's time to wrap this up, because now there's a lot of science still to talk about with this, don't get me wrong, but it seems like as far as sort of the happenings related to this story, they've moved over into the political realm less so than the science. And I mean, I just don't want to do politics, and people don't want to hear me do politics. So for the people who have been yearning for more Banal of America Classic, We'll be doing more paranormal stuff. We're going to get back into the paranormal starting in June. So, you know, the next episode will be our big 10th weekly installment. And we'll declare victory over the coronavirus. And
all right. Okay.
Yeah. Maybe if I could figure out a way, if I had the poll, I'd say next week's episode will be brought to you by nothing but cakes, but we'll celebrate them as well. But that's kind of where I'm at, and I hope people understand where I'm coming from. I mean, you and I have talked about it. It seems kind of like it makes sense. I think just from a personal level, I recall when all this was. I just think back on when we first started this miniseries, and it was like it had a very a 9/11-y feel to it. Everyone was living in the now. We were living in the now. It was like, this is insane. What is happening? This is crazy. The sky is falling. And now it's like, now everyone's just like, shit, well, the sky fell. So how are we gonna pick up the pieces? And so to me, I don't really think there's necessarily a need, maybe, for a Banal of America slant on how we pick up the pieces. But we'll see. But that's kind of the state of the situation right now.
Yeah. Okay.
And I want to say this now. I'll probably say this next week too. But I want to say this now. This program has been built on some incredible people over the last shit. Got to be 15 years now. Been all of America, and you know, we've lost some real titans. I was thinking about Stan Friedman this week, who passed away a year ago Wednesday. So it was the anniversary of his death. And I just want to say that I cannot thank you enough, Tyler, for being a part of this mini-series. In the pantheon of Banal of America, I mean, you're now one of the titans. You're a serious, significant part of the legacy of this program. I could not have done this without you, and I want to thank you now, and I'm going to thank you next week for dedicating your Friday nights to doing this crazy show with me and informing the Banal of America listeners and trying to get everybody through this crisis as best they could. So, you know, if there's a Banal of America Hall of Fame, you're in it, brother. You're definitely in it.
Well, you know, I just say thanks for asking me, Tim, because it's always fun to talk to you. And so I've had a great time. The other shows that we did way back when, you know, we sat there, what did we talk, 3 hours? one night, and that was just crazy. But yeah. always fun, always interesting. And, you know, that's,
yeah.
I think that's part of why somehow you have a rapport and chemistry with people, and they enjoy being on the show, and they want to be on the show. And that's why you had all the people who came on. So you're doing
Absolutely,
good?
Absolutely, yeah. We're going to. Thanks, man. I appreciate it. We're gonna do it again. We're gonna. I was joking with Tyler before the show. I still owe him that 23andMe. So if you thought the All American Coronavirus Special Report was something, wait till you get a load of Banal of America Origins. That's gonna be. We're gonna need maybe more than 3 hours for that one.
Yeah, you're going to find out stuff you don't want to know. So go ahead.
I know.
My day.
So that's it. If you're in the chat and you just got in now, tonight's the penultimate weekly coronavirus show. Next week we're going to wrap it up, and then starting in June we're going to go Banal of America Classic, and we're going to start doing the paranormal stuff again. So with all that said, the first 10 minutes we've wasted on in-house notes. Let's, oh my, Alexa's getting fired up.
Uh-oh.
Oh, this shouldn't be funny, but I find it funny. Watch, Tyler, watch this. Alexa. She can't get on the internet. All right, forget it. So you can ask, I'll hold on to it later. I discovered something, being an ass. Which is sometimes the best way to discover things. Yes, while being an ass, I discovered something funny. So let's talk numbers here as we do at the start of these coronavirus wrap-ups. Again, it's not a good week. I think, it's been the same week after week after week here on the show. You know, we're approaching something of a milestone here in America. We'll probably cross it tomorrow. We're at 1.48 million cases here in the United States. So we'll almost definitely get to 1.5 million cases in America next week. And we probably won't get to 100,000 deaths by next week, but we're at 88,507. And they're saying probably by June 1st. So, I'm aghast at all this. I really am. I'm kind of like heartbroken and disheartened about all this. It's just so, it's just hard to believe, man. It really is just so hard to believe, especially after all these years of seeing these stories. You know, it was like, oh, it's the Zika virus is going to get us, or it's like SARS is going to, be the one, or the bird flu, or the swine flu, and it was like year after year after year. I think that's partially why maybe this caught a lot of people so badly by surprise, because it was just one thing after another of these proposed pandemics that never ended up being this big threat, and now here we are. This one came along and just walloped us right between the eyes.
Yeah, I think you've got something there, Tim, that we've been crying wolf for a long time. I would say with legitimate reason. But, yeah, a lot of these things, like the great comets that are always going to show up and then they fizzle out, people do get jaded. You know, they do get, oh, yeah, I've heard this before. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I think, you know, you're on to something. The other thing to keep in mind is, in terms of the history, we've actually been, in one way, fortunate that some damage wasn't even worse, and it's been pretty horrific. The great pandemic of the last part of the 20th century and first part of the 21st century is HIV. And that
Right.
thing was rampant in the blood supply for years, along with hepatitis C. We were very fortunate that we had as few people killed by it, and it's still raging. I mean, it's not controlled. It's not cured. We know how to defeat it. We know how to break the chain. And I think you're right that we are now, this is the now normal, and so just like we know how to avoid HIV and how to keep it out of the blood supply, that's where we're coming to grips with the coronavirus. This is what you do. This is how you avoid it. This is how you evade it. And we have some solid strategies. So it's not like we're helpless, but we've been in some ways lucky and unlucky at the same time. But we've dodged some bullets, man. Prions, mad cow disease leaping into human beings. Whoa, geez. A little bit of bad luck either way, and that could have been horrific. And who knows, maybe in the next 20 years we'll find out it is still incubating. There's debate about how bad that will be and how threatened the blood supply in some parts of the world is by prions that could be cooking in us. So, you know, it's in a way, it's business as usual. If you consider having to evade death as business as usual, but we've done it before. And I think you're right. We've seen these things before, and we'll just motor on.
Yeah, yeah. It's very strange. It's still very surreal. We talked a lot about the mask thing last week. I don't know if I said this on the show. I know I've said this to other people. It's just really weird, the timetable of things. Like I said, I'm very sort of, I guess because I kind of made the call today that we were going to head to the finish line on this, I kind of thought to myself, I was looking back on things, just that we had no idea sort of the timetable of all this. And I said to you before we started the show, I thought this was going to be like a 6-week lark. I thought we were going to be out of this. I guess maybe I took the president at his word. Maybe I said, maybe I was like, oh, it'll just miraculously disappear by the end of April once the weather gets warm. So I guess wishful thinking applies to all of us. So to me, and now we're at mid-March. Here it is, March 15th. And they're canceling shit way out now. A good example, I guess, in a sense of how the timetable is so askew is I remember when things were getting canceled in April, the people from Roswell, for my paranormal buffs in the audience, they were saying, oh, no, don't worry about it. We're not going to cancel the Roswell Festival. That's in July. So these things that are getting canceled in April, that's totally understandable. We'll be around in July. Don't worry about that. And like last week or something, they canceled the Roswell Festival. I don't think there'll be a major paranormal gathering this year, honestly. I'd be very surprised. And I've said to people, as I said, I lost my train of thought originally, but I don't know if I said this on the show or if I said this. I know I've said it to people in private, but it's like, get ready, folks. You're going to be seeing Santas with masks, man. We're going to have a coronavirus Christmas. We're not going to be out of this by the holidays, I don't think.
Yeah, yeah. It's looking that way. It's definitely looking that way. Well, you can already see that scientific conventions and whatnot are already talking about we're not going to use Zoom necessarily. There may be a lot more WebEx, remote learning, and remote meetings than we ever would have liked. You know, because half of the fun of having the Roswell meeting is to get there and interact with people. And, you know, you can't quite get the same feel, but I think you're right. Now, remember, we've had plenty of fun criticizing people for saying things that didn't hold up. But at the outset, lots of people were saying we might have a parallel to the SARS outbreak of 2002, 2003, where the warm weather, it did seem to help us, you know. Now, SARS is a different beast. We could corner it easier. You know, with flu, certainly we see a seasonal downturn. And so, you know, it's hopeful, but we were hoping. And unfortunately, there's so many susceptibles, it looks like it's going to burn through at some level and then maybe speed up. But this is the thing we have to keep in mind is that every week we learn something new about this thing. And there have been plenty of errors made. You know, plenty of really competent technical people have said things that have not come to pass. And that's just the way it's going to be. If you remember, we were really worried about ventilators. And then I think we mentioned on one of the last shows that the real limiting factor quickly became the ability to do dialysis, and not so much the ventilation. So live and learn, live and learn.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, as we talked about before, the fog of war, at the time, everybody was kind of scrambling, trying to figure out what the hell was going on. And, you know, I think maybe we're coming down off the cusp of this first wave, it seems, maybe. But
yeah.
What's that?
No, I think you're right. And what's going to be interesting is we're also now beginning to release some areas from the stay-at-home orders. And then we'll have to be vigilant to see, you know, if it just leaps back, or if we're lucky and it stays low, we get some time, and we can rearm. But that's what would be my suggestion, is any time that we have where we're a little bit spared from the onslaught, we need to get ready for the possibility of the next onslaught. And I trust that our leaders are doing that.
I hope, but at the very least, the state leaders will. It's particularly disheartening here. I think it's just Massachusetts and Connecticut that haven't started any open-up process yet. We're the only two states left. So,
is that right?
But
okay.
Hey,
wow.
Yeah, we're the only two states left. They're going to announce the plans for Massachusetts reopen on Monday, which leads me to believe they're probably going to extend it from, you know, they're probably going to say June 1st, We do this. So they're going to by Monday. I think on Monday they're going to say that it's not going to take into effect until the beginning of June. But I mean, I'm not losing my mind. I'm not losing my mind here. I'll survive the remaining thing. And to talk a little bit more about sort of how we were saying, it's like you adapt to this crazy life. Again, I'm getting all nostalgic from heading towards the end of the show. It's, you know, when we talked at the beginning of the program, it was very, I was seriously hunkered down. I mean, I didn't leave the house for more than maybe 10 minutes between, what, March 13th and maybe like 2 or 3 weeks ago. And now it's just, you have to function. You have to leave the house. You can't live inside forever. I understand where people are coming from when they start to get agitated about that. Believe me. I mean, I need a haircut, man. I feel these people's pain. But I'm not going to, like, grab a gun and run out into the street and be like, I need a fucking haircut. It's like, it's just annoying. It's just annoying. That's all. So.
Yeah, there's lots of things, though. But I understand that you can only stay in the bunker for so long. Most of us do run out of food, except for the really hardcore preppers. I'm sure that many people have had the same experience, that they were inside for a while and then decided they had to get food or have it delivered at least. It's and again, I think you're right that we can adapt. And so what was initially shocking becomes something that, okay, yeah, that's Tuesday. You know, instead of, oh, my God, this is it. People are adaptable, if nothing else. So do you ever read history of World War II and some of the things that went on, like the siege of Leningrad? I forget how many days they were under siege by the German forces. And they used to mark the streets. The people would still have to get out, and they still have to go around. And they marked the streets, and they would say, this side. Walk on this side. And it's because the Germans were shelling, and the direction was that you were kind of shielded on one side of the street and not the other. And so as the situations would change, they would remark that. But that was what these people put up with for their morning commute, or, you know, they're going out to get water, or towards the end, they're looking for dead things to eat, you know, and trees to cut down to burn. But they held on all that time. They held on. It's just unbelievable what people can do.
Absolutely, yeah. And I've only left the house to get food, but there's nowhere else to go. It's not like I couldn't go anywhere if I wanted to. That's the downside of it all. So, but we'll see what happens. I think, personally, it'll be hard to gauge necessarily this fallout from the reopen. We've talked about this in the past, where just because they open all this shit doesn't mean everyone's going to go. Like, if they reopened Massachusetts on Monday, I would probably still kind of hang inside till July 4th, just to, because if anything, everything's going to be slammed. So if you're dying to go out and grab a beer, the first day the place is open is probably the worst day to go, because everybody in town is going to be there. If you wait maybe a couple weeks and the novelty's off and all the other places are open, then you're going to be a little more safe, I think. But
could be.
We'll see. I mean, like they showed, I don't know if you saw the in Wisconsin, they ordered them to open up everything. Madness. And they slammed, like, the sports bars and shit, and the sports bars were, like, packed. And it's like, first of all, is there only one sports bar in fucking Wisconsin? Like, can't you people go someplace else? Can you spread out a little more? But I don't want to be in that mess of people.
Well, no, and you know, it could have some consequences. But one of the things that I absolutely agree with is they may open up, but a lot of people are just not quite sure yet.
Right.
And one of the things that I worry about at our school is, in particular, our dental program, where we have people that come in from the outside community who need dental work and are willing to let students work on them. And mm-hmm. I think no matter what goes on here, you know, if we open up and nobody comes, the students, boy, I don't know how we get through this. With dentistry, it's a little bit different. When they're done with their program, they are licensed surgeons. They have gone through basically their residency, their practical training, all that during the course of their 4 years. So, yeah, they have a license. They can go out and start working. A lot of the medical students will go through a residency program where they'll get a lot more. But the dental program is highly specialized, and they start right away with simulations, and they're in the clinics pretty quickly. You know, I mean, with maybe not actually working on patients, but watching, helping, and then they're getting right in there.
Yeah.
So we really do need the community to come and support us. You know, the question in my mind is, will people be willing? You know, are they going to be so fearful that dentists will go out of business? And we just don't know. So we just have to sort of wait and see. You know, and try to do our best. There are some recommendations that have been made to how to operate a dental clinic as safely as possible. But will the people accept that? And again, it's the big unknown.
Yeah.
And that's what keeps us up awake at night.
I can imagine. Now, we got a dispatch from Australia here displaying the power of Dental America. Sarah, or Sasquara, I love that name. She's down in Australia. Long time Dental America listener. She says, our restaurants are open for 10 people if they have 4 square meters each and stay 6 feet away from each other, and bars can only serve alcohol with a meal. Same numbers. I don't know what 4 square meters is, so. I guess the restaurant has to have 4 square meters, I guess. Yeah, I don't know.
That's probably the normal social distancing. 6 feet apart would probably get you. That would be your volume, your allowed volume. So, you know, she's coming back in time, right? She's a day ahead of us.
I know.
Did you ever think of that?
She's ahead of us in Australia. So, I love Australia. I've always wanted to go there. It kind of breaks my heart, this whole thing, too, because I had, like, the best year of my life traveling last year. I went to so many places, and it wasn't exotic. I wasn't, like, a rock star. I didn't go to, like, 40 places. I just went to, like, I think I went on, like, 6 trips, which for me was, like, a career highlight. And this year I'm not going to go anywhere. So, and it's like, I don't even know when I had planned a trip to Ireland. I was going to go to Ireland. I would be getting ready to leave for Ireland, like right about now, for some time in the next few weeks. But that never came to fruition. So, and it's like I don't even know when that may even happen, because some of these places, my understanding, like if I wanted to fly to Ireland tomorrow, I don't even know if they let me in. But even if they did, I think you got to stay in like a 2-week quarantine. I know that's for a lot of places. You got to be in quarantine for 2 weeks before they let you out and into the country. So, especially,
yeah.
Talk about, I love America, folks, but talk about what a terrible place we're in right now. We're like the bastard child of the world. They don't want some grubby ass American coming from Boston or Pittsburgh or any of this. Or Poughkeepsie, or Tempe. They don't want any of us coming to fucking Ireland or Australia or any other foreign country. They're like, look it, dude, stay in your shitty, diseased country and fucking don't bring it here. Thank you very much. So we don't need a wall, dude. Nobody wants to come here, and they won't let us leave.
Yes, we're going to reenact Escape from New York.
There's one thing
you got to keep in mind is don't even think about going to Hawaii. They pretty much rolled back the welcome wagon and said, stay away, everybody. We don't want you. Yeah, they've had a number of instances where they've told people, yes, okay, and they have to register at the hotel, and you need to self-quarantine for 2 weeks, and they've caught people violating the agreements or the rules. And I think some they've forced to leave the island summarily, hopefully on a plane. Yeah, I know. I talked to Vaney about this. You know, this is really cruel. But they're
yeah.
serious. And so they have a relatively low number of cases, and they want to keep it down to a manageable, traceable level. That's their goal. And but anyway, yeah, your point is well taken. We won't know for a while. You just have to keep in mind that at some point we will get back to normal. And so, you know, we will be able to travel or whatever. We can't think of where we are now as forever, because we'll be. And we will, I think we mentioned this before, we will find ways to mitigate the infection, to keep it so that the death toll is as good as we can get it. I mean, there'll be monoclonal antibodies. We have hyperimmune serum that I don't know if you saw in the news. They're talking about that's actually working to save people. And eventually we'll get a vaccine. I don't know that it'll be on the time scale of Project Warp or Warp Speed. I can't remember what they were calling it. I don't know that it will happen. Let's hope it can. But eventually
they have some good results. Do you see their Oxford results?
Yes.
Yeah, those are good. For folks who haven't heard of this, they gave the vaccine to like a bunch of monkeys, and I think initially 10 out of 28 or something something like initially a small level were immune to coronavirus after like a couple of weeks. And then after like 4 weeks, all of the monkeys were immune. So it's a promising, the guy said that, you know, this is precisely the results we would want to see. So
yes.
I think, have faith, you know.
Also the importance of this is they were able to challenge this was a real infection. And so the monkeys were encountering basically the virus, the real virus, because a lot of times they have analogs. There's a test called plaque reduction neutralization, and that gives you a pretty good idea that what you're doing is going to work. But there's nothing like this test. This is about as close to doing it in an actual person as you can get. And we assume that everything works fairly closely. Sometimes we're disappointed. But one of the things that may happen, I don't know if it will, is that they may actually get people to volunteer to be exposed to the real virus, to test the vaccine.
That's a question that came up that I wanted to ask you about, because it never occurred to me how they figure this out. I'm going to bring this down to a street level term so people can enjoy my textbook banal interpretation of this. But so if they're testing a vaccine, right, and they shoot you with the needle, then they, what, do they bring you back, like, in a month and then just spray you with fucking coronavirus? Like, that seems kind of dangerous. How do they test this on people? Because I don't know if I'd be like, yeah, sure, I'll test it. And then they give me, all right, come back in a month. Then you come back in a month. And they're like, just stand here for a minute. And they spray you with a fucking spray bottle full of COVID. I wouldn't want to. I'd be like, I'm out, dude. I'm out. You better fucking hope this thing works.
Well,
shit.
Yeah, I'm
literally soaked in the coronavirus. Thank you very much, Doc. How do they test these vaccines on people? They don't do that, right? I hope. They said they did it to the monkeys. But I don't think they do it to people.
They did say that.
They said they subjected them to an intense level of coronavirus. It's like,
yes,
Jesus
they did.
Christ.
Yeah, so you can – yeah, there are things you can get away with in the laboratory, but what is often done is a prospective study where we go ahead and vaccinate people in the area where the disease is still circulating and then come back later and see how many of them got it and didn't get it. Was it significantly different in the control group as opposed to the inoculated group? I think we mentioned maybe last week or the week before that in China – in Wuhan, for example, the level was so low they couldn't adequately test. Same problem with the Ebola situation. As the rates began to drop, it was hard to really see clearly that the vaccine worked. But one thing they can do is there's some analog tests. The plaque reduction thing, that's in basically tissue culture. And we can see that, yeah, we go after the receptor, it has a problem getting into these cells. Therefore, we infer that this could be antibodies that are protective. But the real test of the sauce is the challenge. And that is something that is going to happen basically when a person gets exposed. We can, with volunteers, we could move that up, but you'd have to be very careful about informed consent. And so one of the things that we have with this particular virus is it's not like getting the flu. We don't have a good way to bring you back if you get really ill.
Yeah.
So what they would do, I think, now I'm guessing and putting words in people's mouths, but I think what they would do is have folks that understood what the risks were have banked a bunch of the, call it convalescent serum from people who have survived. That would be their fallback if somebody got really seriously ill. And then go ahead and say, all right, now we're going to give you X number of viruses. And they'll put a dose into the person's nose, something they think approximates what you might be exposed to, and then you stand back. And so you could do that ethically. You would have the person there where they're watched, where you tell them, look, if you get a fever or whatever, you have to tell us right away. And then they prepare. So this would be a foreseeable adverse event that the vaccine didn't protect, didn't work, and you have to bring the person back. But there's still a risk. I'm not going to kid you. That may actually happen. They may seek probably be young, healthy volunteers that they think are going to respond to the vaccine. They'll test them first. They'll be sure that they're getting antibody titers, you know, that it looks like, oh, yeah, it's up there. We think this is in a realm where it works, but that's still guesswork. And then they'll challenge them. And that'll be probably something that would move this up ahead by months. So I think that could be done. I have to let the ethicists weigh in on this. You know, but it's a challenge. And you can see there are some worries here. We don't want to harm anybody in the testing. And again, our knowledge is very imperfect. One of the things that you have to keep in mind, this is the informed consent part. You know, we could make an error. If you've got a person who's fully immune to normal levels, like somebody coughs, you breathe it in, you get infected, that's one thing. Now, Dr. Tim, what's your challenge dose going to be? How many viruses are you going to put in that person? You're going to shoot them right up their nose. And let me tell you, you give them too many, you could overwhelm their immunity, and they'll get sick right there before, you know, right in front of your eyes almost. So you have to balance this. Yeah, I mean, this is serious business, and there's a lot of ways it can go wrong. And so we don't know, like, how much of the antigen do we give if we're giving a standard vaccine? to get a good response in this person? Is one dose sufficient? Do we need two? Do we need an adjuvant?
Yeah.
How much time in between? These are all the variables that will drive you mad when you're trying to make sure you don't hurt somebody, kill somebody in the testing phase. So there's so many ways this could fall off the rails. I think it can be done. I think it will be possible to do it in a way where we could probably not subject the person to high probability of death, provided we agree that convalescent serum is protective. But this gets hairy. You know, and you can imagine you're going to induce somebody to follow your protocol and then think about the idea that, but what if I'm wrong? What if I make an error and this young man dies or this young woman dies because of it? This is where it weighs heavily on these scientists. Trust me, it weighs heavily on them.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was thinking about that, actually. I think all this coronavirus stuff got me looking into vaccines and everything. And it was Jonas Salk was the one who did the smallpox.
Polio.
Polio. All right, I'm thinking about the guy who injected his neighbor. Well, the guy who invented vaccines. Who was the guy that invented vaccines?
Edward Jenner.
Yeah. He got it from like the ladies milking the cows. They couldn't get whatever it was. I thought it wasn't smallpox then.
It was, they called it cowpox, and the virus is known as vaccinia. The smallpox virus is different. It's known as variola. And so a lot of people had known before Jenner that milkmaids or people that got cowpox didn't tend to be afflicted by the smallpox when the disease came around. And so for years, there were actually two types of disease, smallpox, known as major and minor. And they had a practice called variolation, which was actually done on Jenner when he was a kid and almost killed him. But you tried to give them the minor disease to prevent them getting the major lethal disease later. But he kind of put this all together. He was very good technically at what he did. He recognized the cowpox, and he knew how to keep those samples clean or whatnot. He actually tested it first on his son, Ed Jenner Jr.
And
he challenged. Yeah. And how did he prove that it worked? He challenged him with real smallpox. Yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
And like 2 weeks later, he said, hey, EJ, come here.
See, because I'm reading here. That's kind of what I got down to. Yeah, where it says, on May 14th, 1796, Jenner tested his hypothesis by inoculating James Phipps, an 8-year-old boy who was the son of his gardener. So it's like, I want to know more.
Yeah.
Somebody must have written about this somewhere. I want to know who the fuck designed it. Why did this gardener? Like, he's just like, all right, fine, I guess, sure. Try it. Try it on my boy, James. Like, who the fuck? That's so crazy.
There's a book called The Virus Hunters. And a chapter in that book is called The Man Who Listened to the Milkmaid. And it's the story of Jenner's sort of recognition, discovery, and method. But, Tim, you know, before he did the public demonstration on James Phipps, he had tested it, on his kid.
That makes sense.
Well, I'll tell you, it's pretty hairy. So his, as I understand it, Jenner's mentor as a physician, a natural physician, was John Hunter. And I think that the eminent Dr. Hunter was interested in proving, interested in syphilis or gonorrhea. There was an argument about which one was, I think gonorrhea. And so he actually, the story is, and I don't know if this is 100% verified, gave himself gonorrhea to prove that it was transmissible. Yeah. And he managed that, but he also gave himself syphilis, which is infinitely worse, because that's not a gonorrhea infection, as horrible as it can be, a symptomatic infection will resolve, although sometimes with a lot of damage. Syphilis a lot of times does not. So action oriented. I think Hunter's admonishment to his students was don't think, do. And so Jenner obviously internalized that one.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. Now, our man in Florida, Jim Vujovic, says the gyms are opening on Monday, and his operatives, which I hope isn't him, but he says his operatives tell him that the bars in Clearwater were shoulder to shoulder. So, again,
well,
people need to just chill out just because the bars are, Jesus Christ, you know. I guess it's all these young people, Tyler. It's all these young people.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess if we think, like, who the average victim of lethality is, it tends to be older, but this disease agent is unpredictable. And we've seen so many sad stories where young, healthy people have been afflicted badly. I hope
yeah.
this works out okay for them, you know. But everybody make good choices, you know.
Now,
make
we talked
sure
about
you gotta
this.
Get that.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, if you got to be at that bar, make sure it was worth it.
Yeah, Stuart says he's in the UK and people are getting itchy after 6 weeks of lockdown. So we got a listener in the UK, we got someone in Australia, we got Copley in San Francisco area, and we got Jim Vujovic down in Florida. So we're covering quite a swath here on the map tonight on the coronavirus special report.
You're all the way across the world, man.
I know. We got we're coast to coast, as one might say. The interesting, well, and Stuart says this is kind of in keeping with what we got going on here in America. He says more and more people are coming out, and the police are finding it hard to enforce the rules now. It's interesting. Someday I'll look back and listen to these shows again and enjoy sort of reliving the experience as an observer instead of as a participant. But yeah, I mean, we're seeing sort of the end result of the debate we were talking about a few weeks ago. It seems like a lot of it is that the whole idea of erring on the side of caution, while they still are advising people to be cautious, it seems like any sort of, save for, say, Massachusetts, which hasn't opened up yet, for most places, the opening up is now underway. And
yes.
It seems like maybe if they had their druthers, a lot of these places would have liked to be waiting as long as Massachusetts. But they kind of had their hand forced because the people just couldn't sustain themselves in under lockdown any longer. So I think that's kind of what we have going on here in America now.
And you know, different areas have, I think, accepted the lockdown more or less, actively than others. We were kind of slow here in Arizona, but the governor did eventually sort of move ahead to bring the slowdown. But we're lifted today, I think, is the, everything is coming up starting today. We've already had a few things. But, you know, one thing, I assume at one point you'll write something about this. Am I correct? Your COVID memoirs? You're thinking along those lines?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe someday. When I eventually write my autobiography, there'll be a chapter on the COVID years or the COVID weeks or,
okay.
you know, the COVID crisis.
You might want to go ahead and grab some of these screenshots or whatever and say, yeah, this is kind of what we were up against, you know, that some people were really anxious to get out and others. Because at that point, in retrospect, you'll be able to know how that really worked. Because one of the things that might happen in 5 years is that there will be a new narrative that describes the whole story. And it's kind of funny how these work. And having lived through Vietnam, we went through a couple of different narratives there over the years. And if you talk to kids today, they don't even remember it. And so what we might see is people who are incredulous that these things happen, that what they really did that, they really – you know, they thought that with the science, for example, they thought it was just going to go away. And yeah, heck yes, we did. We were hoping anyway, but happened once before, you know. But a lot of things that I think people will just simply not quite really believe when we look backwards with the passage of time.
Well, we got a couple of insights here from the chat room. Jim Vujovic says, still down in Florida, he's telling us that he knows of some restaurants that opened at 25% capacity and had literally not one customer all day. This is the situation. This is the tenuous. This is kind of the point that I think that we were trying to get across to the hardcore open it up. It's like you can force everything open tomorrow, dude, but nobody's going to show up. We need to know for sure that things are cool. So, yeah. And it ties back to that conspiracy idea, Jim, that we talked about on the show a few weeks ago. Where now, look at who's on the hook. The fucking restaurants, right? They're on the hook because the government's going to be like, well, we're not going to fucking bail you out, dude. You were open. You had the chance to be open, and you couldn't. You weren't like the sports bar, I guess. You couldn't. You didn't sell out or whatever, so you didn't have any customers, and now you can't pay the rent. You know, we can't forgive you for not paying the rent, considering you were open. So it's this is where we're going to see a second. People talk about the second wave of the virus, but I think we're going to see a second wave of economic destruction soon-ish. As they just announced like the retail numbers. They said retail's down like 16%. And that's, I presume, those numbers come from about a month ago or something. So, or maybe the end of April. So it's like we're going to see the economic numbers are going to get worse. They're going to keep getting bad and shit because people are going to try to open and they're not going to be able to because people aren't going to want to come out.
Or there'll be few enough people that come out that all of the restaurants that once used to thrive, there's just not enough in the ecosystem to keep them going. So, you were talking about traveling, and it'll be a while before people really feel comfortable maybe flying again. It could be years. It could be years. This is the damage that just can't be undone, at least not overnight. I'm confident.
Yeah,
we'll get
it's a
there,
very
– that...
Got...
No, you know, we'll get there eventually, but, geez, you know, people need to eat now. And so we're trying. You know, we're trying to come up with something.
Yeah, it's very the psyche of the country, and I think a lot of the Western world is on edge right now. So,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
We'll see what happens. Somebody suggested, would you know if opening up was safe if after a couple of weeks? That's sort of the rule of thumb, right? It's like, well, let's see how it goes for a couple of weeks, and if we see a huge spike. But even then, I'm getting more and more irritated with the indecipherable nature of this disease, to be quite honest. Tonight on the news, there was a lot of shit about, okay, you know, again, it's like, look back on this show. We're going to hear so many things we said that were either incredibly prescient and terrifying or, like, really wrong. But the Abbott super fast testing machine, now they're saying it's not that great. It's only right, like, 50% of the time or something insane like that. So, again, it's like, if you think I'm taking a fucking vaccine, the first one they rushed to the market as part of Operation Space Force Warp Speed, I ain't taking any of that shit, dude.
That's the...
I'll go back on intense lockdown before I do that. Shit. But yeah, dude,
well,
that's kind of the point I'm trying to make, though. It's like they're saying, okay, some people get tested, it comes back negative, but they're sure they have it, and they get tested again, and then it says they have it. It's like, oh my God, this is just such a fucking nightmare, dude.
Yes. Now, one thing that you have to keep in mind is all of these tests have limitations in places where they're useful and places where they're not so useful. It's not uncommon for the rapid test in particular to be basically checked out by the manufacturers. And they will come up with a 99% specificity, 99% sensitivity. But when they do that, they're oftentimes testing with contrived, pure samples, not quite what they're going to get in the field. So you almost never get the published level of sensitivity. Now, the workaround for the false negative would be sequential testing, and that would be get a negative, test it again. And if you get a positive and you think that probably the sensitivity is good, you can go ahead and act on that. Much depends on what the consequences of the call would be. You know, if it's a diagnosis, send you home, say no problem, and you get everybody infected, obviously, then you're going to do a sequential test and maybe even a different type of test if you can. We do this with HIV. We have the person comes through and they have a relatively insensitive quick test that can pick them up under some circumstances. If that turns up positive, then they go ahead and do a more exact and definitive test, also more expensive and time-consuming, to make the formal diagnosis of HIV positive. But those tests, every one of them that relies on antibodies that are often used against HIV, will fail if the person comes in too soon. And so with these other tests, there's a window. There's a window that you can hit. And if you're lucky, you get the antigen and you get them. And if you're not, you can be totally misled. We just have to be cognizant of the fact that none of these things are perfect. We cannot think that we're going to get one answer and that is it. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say that when they test the people in the White House, they do two, maybe three iterations of the test right then and there. And they say, okay, three out of three, probably okay. One hit, trouble. So there's a general, you know, I mean, this is just how it is. These rapid tests in particular, they have limitations.
Yeah, well, they said that on the news tonight. That's what got me into this topic. They said they're starting to figure out that issue of the window, where it's like if they test people at within like 4 days, I think it was something like that, it's not as good as if they get them at like 6 days, where it's like it picks it up more readily at like 6 days, right when they start showing the symptoms.
Yes.
So the whole thing with the asymptomatic thing, that's even more troubling.
It really
will. We'll see. Again, it's the indecipherable nature of this that drives me nuts. Jim Vujovic wants to know if it's true that vaccine immunity is less robust and not as long-lasting as immunity from a natural exposure.
You know, it almost always is. And the reason I say that is because our history with the artificial vaccinations is long. And so with a lot of these things, in particular, this may freak you out. But some of the vaccines actually don't prevent infection. They prevent the disease. Okay, so if you go back to the polio vaccine of Salk, the inactivated polio vaccine, that was a shot. And it induces really, really good titers that will just kill the hell out of the virus in the bloodstream. But it won't stop you from being infected. And the virus often comes in, it's a GI system virus, and so people excrete it in the fecal matter. So we can have the vaccine or the virus circulating basically through the environment. If it tries to travel through the bloodstream, boom, you got it, okay? It's not going to paralyze. And so we are protected by virtue of the fact that the disease now is fairly well controlled here and with early vaccination. But strange but true, the vaccine has some limitations. If you think about, I don't know if Jim had do you get chickenpox vaccine as a kid or you get chickenpox the natural way? But the chickenpox I bring up because that's a live attenuated. And those viruses are weakened, but the live attenuated vaccines are typically very powerful because the virus grows in you, goes through a natural life cycle, and induces the body to fight them off. They're pretty good. But the chickenpox vaccine, the first one called Varivax, had an agonizing problem known as breakthrough. And what would happen is you'd vaccinate the kids 2 years later, come back with chickenpox, you know, as soon as they got exposed. So the workaround for breakthrough is to give two administrations of the vaccine. So one about age two, another one before they go into preschool or school, say age five. And that brings it down to a low level. But the controversy with the Varivax vaccine is that a lot of people believe, no, getting infected with chickenpox the natural way is superior because you have lifelong immunity. That's actually wrong. Chickenpox doesn't come back as chickenpox. It comes back as shingles. You don't have lifelong immunity. People don't understand that. It got a strange name because the diseases look so different. But so anyway, you don't have lifelong immunity even with the natural infection. And that's the way a lot of the viruses work, is that you're good for a while and it drops down even with the natural viruses. Our vaccines, honestly, many times are pretty similar. They're solid for a while, just solid enough, you know, to get us through to where we need, and we can be protected by herd immunity. So we count on having good compliance, and that sort of is the final safety net for us. But that's a good question, and it's one that we have to worry about clinically, in particular with kids who are going to undergo chemotherapy or whatever. We want to be sure that we've got them as protected as we can before we start all those processes. But, the vaccines have limitations, too. The ones we've given our animals really do. And we those are just good enough to get them out there. You know, just get these pigs through the cycle, slaughter them, we're done. And so they're called leaky. And they actually infect each other a lot. Yeah, it's cool. Don't think about it too much, okay? Yeah, just
try not
everything
to.
Before you eat it, Tim.
I always do.
Good man.
Yeah. Or even better, I have someone else cook it for me. So.
Okay. It's a plan.
With all this talk of bundt cakes, I should try and do my own bundt cake. Maybe maybe I will. Not for next week, but maybe when we return for an update episode, I'll roll out my bundt cake.
Finale.
What's up?
That might be the final strategy. Just threaten these people that, look, unless you want a competitor, you need to sponsor this program.
Yeah. I'll be like, look, they got a wicked head start on me, though. I got to say this, though, in a testament to I should have been a preacher or something, or I should be in sales, because I'm counting now. Let me see. We got Copley, Vujovic, Farr, my buddy Aaron Gullius. What's that? Four people. I think Jack Brewer. I'd have to double check with him, but I think Jack Brewer have all indulged in the nothing bundt cakes since I brought it to the attention of the world. So,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. It's pretty good if you really think about it. I inspired five other people around the country to partake in nothing bundt cakes.
Oh, no. It's more than that, Tim. It's Dr. Gullius, right? Am I correct?
I don't think Aaron's a doctor. No, I don't think so. He's a professor. He's a professor,
okay.
But he's not a doctor.
Okay. So then he can influence all of his students. So what you have is a cascade of customers that you are sort of cultivating for this company.
Yes.
Think about that. All right? So...
Sasquara said she looked at in Australia for a nothing bundt cake. So see, we could open one down there. But
it's across the world, thanks to you. You know?
They're
outstanding. I mean, if you could have only had that in the film with Go Rightly, you know? Featured little buntinis or something. If only you could go back and
I haven't mentioned this on the show, but folks, the hill and the hole. Let me see. Actually, this is a good halfway point. Good idea, Tyler. I'm putting more work on my plate. But for folks who are unaware, I'm in a movie with Adam Go Rightly, and Adam actually taped a little video. There's a video thing, an intro to the movie. To like introduce people to the movie. So what I'm going to do now, not like right now live, but what I'm going to do on the MP3 is I'm going to play Adam's little 1 minute account of what this movie's all about. And so people can find out.
Hi, this is Adam Go Rightly, star of Stage and Screen, and I play Roger Person in the Bright Rectangle production of The Hill and the Hole, a film about high weirdness in the high desert. The Hill in the Hole is a madcap romp filled with fried dough trucks, Masonic temples gone south, and a town of tortured souls feeding themselves to the past. The film revolves around the misadventures of an archaeologist named Tom Digby, who got more than he bargained for when a simple surveying assignment turned into a dance on the dark side. The Hill in the Hole is adapted from a Fritz Lieber short story of the same name and was filmed in late July and early August during the mystical dog days in various locales in New Mexico, Colorado, and Massachusetts. It could best be described as a paranormal thriller with a little Jim Jarmusch here and some Twin Peakishness there. But with all that being said, I think the film is unique unto itself, a mix of comedy, drama, high weirdness, and horror. Influenced to a certain degree by directors Ernst and Darman's interest in Fortiana. It was a blast making the film, and while in Massachusetts, I had the chance to hook up with my old pal Tim Banal, who plays the role of my fry cook assistant, Tiny. The movie also features a cast of young and talented actors. That includes Liam Kelly, Kristen Brody, Brant Adams, Chris Dunlap, Matthew O'Donnell, Ricardo Burgos, William McLean, and a cool and creepy film score by Drew O'Doherty. Burial mounds, Masonic death cults, giant astral deities demanding blood sacrifice, fried Mars bars. What do all these things have in common? You are about to find out.